This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. I feel like the internet and I have become an old married couple, the way it's always finishing my sentences. When we turn on our phones and search engines, we can count on suggestions for what we might be looking for and the word we meant to type. Predictive technology has bounded forward in the 21st century, but a long-forgotten company, started in the Cold War era, laid the groundwork. The Simulmatics Corporation used data to simulate human behavior and predict the future. Its short existence holds important lessons for our relationship with technology today. Jill Lepore is a professor of American history at Harvard University, the staff writer at The New Yorker, and host of the podcast The Last Archive, and the author of If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future. Jill, welcome to The State of Things.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Tell us more about the Simulmatics Corporation, founded in 1959 for what?
It was founded to help the Democrats get a president back in the White House after two terms of Dwight Eisenhower and with the prospect of his successor, Richard Nixon, running for the presidency in 1960.
Started by, one of the founders, a very colorful character who you profile as part of your book. Tell us about Ed Greenfield and Bill McPhee, also a colorful character.
Yeah, Greenfield was a Madison Avenue admin, you know, kind of proverbial madman. Really slick, very charming, quite brilliant, really a devoted civil rights activist and advocate of liberal causes, which was kind of unusual on Madison Avenue. A lot of those big ad agencies, you know, they serve big businesses. The Republican Party was the party of business. And Democrats who wanted to use ad agencies to help them in their political campaigns were kind of hard-pressed, partly because they didn't really believe in ad agencies interfering in politics. Certainly Adlai Stevenson, who ran as a Democratic nominee in 52 and 56, didn't. But his campaign did hire Greenfield to do some work for the Stevenson campaign. And Greenfield was really frustrated that Stevenson didn't take a stronger position on civil rights. And so were, you know, so were many Northern liberals who were really concerned that the Democrats would lose again in 1960. So Greenfield, though, was also super interested in the latest sort of best and brightest scientific research going on in universities. He was really interested in computers. And he put together, he's kind of like a Danny Ocean from Ocean's 11. He put together this sort of dream team of guys to build a computer program that could help convince the Democratic Party that it needed to take a stronger position on civil rights.
Yeah, and I guess that's an important point here. Number one, he's a liberal. He's got this idea about civil rights. He wants the Democratic Party to pay more attention to, on the one hand, public relations. Adlai Stevenson never accused of being a public relations guy. But on the other hand, it was going to be data-driven. This is new. I mean, there's intuition. A good politician gets what the constituents want, what they're looking for. And Greenfield's innovation here is to say, wait a minute, I can prove to you that what you think is a bad idea, taking a strong stand on civil rights, would actually be a winner for you. And he tries this with the Kennedy campaign, right?
Exactly. So he and Bill McPhee, who's a mathematical sociologist at Columbia, and a guy from IBM who invented the first program to teach a computer to play chess, they together write this Fortran program for one of these giant IBMs. They call it the People Machine. What it is it's an election simulator. It's really the kind of biggest data science project in the social sciences at the time. They collect all the old punch cards that the polling agencies Gallup and Roper have. They collect election returns. They have census data on punch cards. And they create a mathematical model of a perfectly representative American population. And then what they claim is that they can conduct infinite simulations of if a candidate took a different position on this issue, it would affect the following voter groups in this way. So it's a really elaborate project all designed to do one thing, which is to convince the Democrats that black votes matter. And that's Greenfield's big mission, is to convince first the DNC, which takes a much stronger position on civil rights at the convention, its platform committee in 1960, and then the Kennedy campaign, after Kennedy becomes the nominee. There's a whole bunch of reports for the Kennedy campaign as well.
And therein lies an instructive difference between sort of how they had to do it, which is to say, we're going to make this proposition, and then we're going to make the algorithm ourselves based on our ideas. You know, if you did this, what would happen? We've got a database here, but we're the ones asking the questions, much different than AI today, which simply takes the data from your purchase history and says, that guy's going to buy this next, right?
Yeah, there's nothing I mean, this is very, very clunky. I mean, this is incredibly innovative and visionary for the time, but these are really slow computers. The amount of data, while, you know, the biggest at the time available, is really small. And so, yeah, it is, it's kind of, from our vantage, quite handmade.
But so how was he able to sell it?
He was an unbelievable pitch guy. Like, he could, this guy could sell you Brooklyn Bridge. he was really incredibly charming. Everybody writes about him in that way. Kind of guy, you know, when you write about someone like that, oh, I wish I could have met Ed Greenfield.
Yeah.
he was a very seductive fellow. And he also had what was, I think, a really bold vision, which he had anticipated, I think, from the very beginning, that this would be a project that he could take beyond the world of politics and into many other realms of life. So after Kennedy wins in November of 1960, Simulmatics claims credit. Greenfield runs a publicity blitz, hires a PR guy, and the company goes public in the spring of 1961. And it's what really drew me to the project was coming across its stock offering in the archives at MIT. And it's just it's like, the company proposes to estimate probable human behavior by use of computer technology. So I'm just like scratching my head, like, this is 1964.
Right. Where does this, and by the way, the Kennedy campaign and then the Kennedy administration, not too happy with his claims.
No, because, you know, everyone understood that this looked pretty bad. It looked nefarious. And a lot of people that Greenfield had reached out to, including Stevenson's advisors, when it seemed like Stevenson was going to run in 1960, said, you know, this should be illegal. Like, this is no way to run politics. This will destroy democracy. You're going to just basically simulate the election infinitely and convince candidates to massage their messages based on, you know, what they should say to particular communities of people. We'll have a highly, like, segmented, incredibly micro-devised, you know, divided American population. It will destroy our sense of political community. We'll have a kind of hyper-personalized politics. It should be, this is wrong. You shouldn't do it. And it'll make any candidate who uses this technology will have to have deniability because it looks so bad. And so the Kennedy campaign kind of fascinatingly tried to deny that they had used Simulmatics, said, you know, we never even heard of this company.
Right. Well, and also there's a lot of sort of dystopian fiction that's coming out around this very question, right? You know, the idea that this could be our future.
Yeah, there are two dystopian novels published about Simulmatics, both in 1964. One of them is this crazy science, really fun, campy science fiction book called Simulacron 3 that actually goes on to be the inspiration for The Matrix. It's about the revelation that we're all living in a simulation, that these simulations have become so sophisticated. It's about a company called the Simulextronics Corporation. And so it's a dystopia in which people begin to realize that they live in a simulation. So,
an even worse name than the real company, but go
even,
ahead.
Yeah. An even worse name. How do you even pronounce that? The other is a book called The 480. So Simulmatics had divided the population into 480 possible voter types. And it's a book written by Eugene Burdick, who was an incredible intellectual celebrity, kind of a scale we don't even really have anymore. He was a political theorist at the University of California, Berkeley, famous for writing The Ugly American, which was made into a film starring Marlon Brando. He also wrote Failsafe, which was made into a film by Sidney Lumet starring Henry Fonda. And everybody thought the 480 would be the kind of knockout film of the middle of the 1960s. Burdick died and the thing kind of fell apart. But Burdick had worked for Greenfield in 1956, helping out with the Stevenson campaign, and had been asked to join Simulmatics in 1959 and said no because he thought it was a very bad, very bad idea. So he writes this dystopian novel about a company called Simulations Enterprise, which is a very thinly veiled Simulmatics Corporation, and it's about how this dark underworld of American politics will destroy democracy.
Well, the interesting thing is the nightmare came true, but not through Simulmatics, which actually went out of business pretty quickly. But and also you reflected on, again, we talked about the comparative lack of sophistication. There's no real AI in this, which really brings us to one of the things that you reflect on in your book, which is this is a company of white liberal men trying to understand the behavior of the rest of the world, including people of color and women. Talk a little bit about, you know, who is sort of manning the punch cards once they threw the women out. It's an interesting story.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is this tiny company that completely fails. So, you know, its influence is not in what it did, but kind of what it imagined. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about why it was imagining this. And, you know, this is, it's sort of a kind of both the promise and the limits of mid-20th century American liberalism. It's, you know, really like a bunch of white men who are baffled, you know, who are baffled by women and people of color. Sort of like, what do women want? What do black people want? And these particular guys, these kind of like the David Halberstam best and the brightest, these, you know, kind of Ivy League-y scientists who are, you know, very worshipped by the culture as a whole, right? It's very the height of the Cold War. You know, to be a scientist is to be a kind of a minor god, and they come to believe that the problems of politics and consumption and anything else to do with the political order, you know, race riots, race relations, U.S. foreign policy, that if they could only build a computer that could figure out what people want, and then influence them and make them want the things that the people that made the computer wanted them to want, you know, that they want to figure out how to get women, convince women to buy, you know, a different dog food for their, or buy a different washing machine brand, or, you know, they want to try to convince political parties what messages to use. They end up doing all this work for the Department of Defense in Vietnam, trying to kind of puzzle out the Vietnamese mind. And there's something, you know, unnerving and haunting to me about that with, you know, tremendously wonderful people work in companies for Silicon Valley, but there's also a kind of weird, creepy kind of ethos of the place of, you know, these companies trying to sort of tell you what you want.
Well, it's fascinating because it does go back, does it not? I know this is outside the scope of your book, which is wonderful, and it's a great look at this company and the people that put it together. But as far back as FDR, who, when democracy itself was really in question, whether or not democracy was going to carry forward in the 20th century in the world, was a serious question. And for FDR, public opinion polling might be the answer. Finding out what people wanted would make better leaders of us all, you remember? So the impulse, it seems to me, goes back at least that far.
Absolutely, and it's part of the fight against fascism, right? So fascism in the 1930s, you know, is revealed to be, you know, what it is telling people what to believe. And public pollsters, you know, George Gallup founds the American Institute of Public Opinion in 1935, and, you know, runs this nationwide syndicated newspaper column called America Speaks. It's the answer to fascism, because instead of people telling the people what to think, Gallup is going to find out what people think and then ask leaders to listen to them. It's the promise of democracy, is to listen to the people. And so polling is ushered in and is celebrated as, you know, amplifying the voices of the people. Our votes are our voices, right? The two words etymologically have the same root. Like, we use our voices, that's when we vote. But Gallup said, you know, we can use our voices in other ways, too. Well, I'll just ask people questions all the time. I'll use this scientific means, and we'll be able to tell leaders what people think. But the pollsters were criticized for much the same reason that Simulmatics was much criticized, by people who studied actual politics, people who were political theorists. There's this great indictment of the polling industry that's published in 1948 by a political theorist named Lindsay Rogers, and he says, you know, it doesn't matter whether this stuff is accurate or not. Like, I don't think it really works. But if it did work, it's still working in a system that is not the political system that we have. We elect people to represent us, to exert leadership, to decide what is best. And sure, they should think about, you know, what the people want and listen to what people have to say. But there is a quality of representation that is different from that of delegation, right? We don't delegate our leaders to do our bidding. We elect them to represent our interests. That is the interest of everybody.
Talking to Jill Lepore about her book, If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future, and talking about that on the state of things. And, of course, the other part of that, Jill, is that if you find out what 60% of the people want, you still have to figure out and take a leadership role in dealing with the 40% who are very unhappy with delivering to the 60% what they in their poll said they wanted. And that's where the leadership comes in.
That's where the leadership comes in. And that's where, you know, one of the critiques of polling is the way in which it's strictly majoritarian. And so much of our constitutional system is designed to protect political minorities.
So let's talk.
Polling doesn't do that.
Well, let's talk about, get back to Simulmatics. It was only in business for 11 years. What led to its demise?
So, you know, it was really costly to hire the services of Simulmatics. They didn't have their own computers. Remember, like, nobody had computers. Like, a couple of big businesses had computers. So they had to rent computer time to provide services to any of their clients, had to pass all that expense on to their clients. So just like as a business proposition, it wasn't really a great idea. And then, you know, by the middle of the 1960s, most ad agencies that are really big companies do get their own computers. They're doing what Simulmatics does, and they can outbid them on jobs. So they kind of fail in that. element of their business. They then get a series of really big contracts with the Department of Defense. They open up an office in Saigon where they're not really doing computer work, but they're basically doing kind of public opinion polling of Vietnamese peasants. This is really controversial work. It's part of Robert McNamara, Johnson's Secretary of Defense, kind of counterinsurgency psychological warfare campaign of hearts and minds. The head of that part of Simulmatics is a political scientist at MIT. MIT has been a very quiet campus during the anti-war movement in the 1960s, but in 1968, Noam Chomsky, who's a linguist at MIT, becomes really prominent in the anti-war movement, and he takes on Simulmatics. In the pages of the New York Review of Books, he writes a whole indictment about his colleague, Ithiel de Solapool, who's the chairman of the research board for Simulmatics. Student protesters at MIT begin protesting outside Poole's office. They hold a trial of Poole, a mock trial of him for war crimes. There's just a lot of political attacks on the company for its role in Vietnam. And then, meanwhile, Greenfield's life is really falling apart. Most of these guys had very fraught marriages. One of the things that was really heartbreaking in working on this book was thinking about those marriages and reading the letters that their wives wrote about how they were treated by these men who were, you know, these geniuses of human behavior who didn't understand their wives and their children. Greenfield's wife dies quite tragically in 1968. And between that and the student protests at MIT in 1969, the company just can't survive and declares bankruptcy in 1970.
Jill Lepore, professor of American history at Harvard University, staff writer at The New Yorker, also the author of If Then, How the Simulmatics Corporation Invented the Future. Jill, this has been great. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.